Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off. The party continues on the Parkway in Philadelphia. The NFL draft is in its second day. It drew thousands to the city on Thursday. And a bit of history. Philadelphia was home to the very first draft held at the Ritz-Carlton way back in 1936 when beleaguered Eagles owner Burt Bell came up with the draft idea as a way to help even the playing field for his hapless Eagles. Well, we wouldn't call the Eagles of 2017 hapless. Rebuilding is more like it. And last night, they tried to add a major building block. WHYY reporter J. Scott Smith was at the festivities and had his recorder rolling when NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell announced the 14th pick.
With the 14th pick in the 2017 NFL Draft, the Philadelphia Eagles select Derek Barnett, defensive end, Tennessee.
All right. And here to help us parse that choice is Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Great to have you back, Mike.
Hi, Mary. Thanks so much for having me.
So what do you think? A mixed reaction from the crowd there.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good pick. I think the reason the crowd's reaction was, as you said, mixed is because there is a sense among diehard fans of the team that this is a position, Barnett is a defensive end, he's supposed to go after the quarterback. This is a position that the Eagles have been trying to address in several drafts for a while now. And the fact that they're still looking for players at that position, I think, probably disappointed some of the fans. I also think that whenever you don't draft an offensive player, there's a little bit of disappointment amongst fans. And since Barnett is a defensive end, I'm sure people who love the Eagles were saying, oh, why didn't they pick somebody who could help Carson Wentz, our star quarterback?
Yeah. Well, in his college career, Barnett broke Reggie White's sack record, so that's quite something there. The question, his name had come up a bunch of times, but also along with the question, is he athletic enough overall?
Oh, I think so. He's a little bit undersized, which is kind of funny to say for somebody who's 6'3" and 260 pounds. But at defensive end in the NFL, that might be a slight concern. But from an athletic standpoint, he's got everything you'd want. He played in the Southeastern Conference for Tennessee. The Southeastern Conference is regarded as the best league in college football. And as you said, he set the sack record at Tennessee with 33 over three seasons, breaking Reggie White's record. So, from a physical standpoint, he's got everything you'd want. He can really manhandle the offensive linemen who are trying to block him. The question is, of course, whether that athleticism will translate to a higher level at the NFL.
Yeah, so many of the Eagles fans were looking to see if the Eagles would draft a cornerback in the first round. What is the need there? Eagle safety Malcolm Jenkins has said, we are searching for a true number one corner, which means what, Mike?
Well, it means somebody who you could have cover an opposing team's top wide receiver and basically not have to worry about that wide receiver anymore. And the Eagles haven't had one of those players in a long while. Now, the upshot of there are two upshots of taking Barnett in the first round last night. Number one is that presumably a better pass rush and putting more pressure on opposing quarterbacks helps your cornerbacks, no matter who they might be. It's easier to cover when the quarterback is under duress and can't look down the field because he's so worried about who might hit him. The other thing is that this is regarded as a draft that is very deep at cornerback, and the sense among scouts and player personnel people is that the Eagles should be able to get a starting caliber cornerback or two in the second and third rounds of this draft.
Yeah, Marlon Humphrey of Alabama's gone, but there are more.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's just get to some of the flavor of the draft. As it opened last night, Roger Goodell received a good old Philly welcome from the Boo Birds. why is that? And were these just Eagles fans? Hey, Mike, we're breaking up a little bit. Are you in range?
Can you hear me now, Mary?
Yes, sorry. Yes, I can. That's okay.
Yeah, no, this is Philadelphia, right? I mean, we do boo commissioners, and that's just kind of how we do things. So I think that was a big part of it. I don't think Goodell was generally well-liked amongst, run-of-the-mill average football fans. He comes off as corporate and stuffy and all those sorts of things. But I do think that last night reflected very well on the city of Philadelphia. And I do think that it might turn out to be revolutionary in a way. I mean, the reports are this morning that there were 100,000 people in and around the art museum for the draft last night. So if you're the NFL and you're looking at this, and you've got to be saying to yourself, you know, if we hold the draft every year in a football mad city, whether it's Philadelphia or Cleveland or Buffalo, you know, Baltimore, places like that, why would you ever have it inside again? You know, forget the idea of holding it in a ballroom or a hotel the way Burt Bell did back in the 1930s.
Yeah.
Let's turn it into a street fair every single year.
Oh, I'm sorry for interrupting you. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. It's just fine.
No, I was going to say, you know, the weather miraculously cleared up on Thursday. It was really nasty earlier this week. So that might be a reason to kind of be a little, you know, there might be a little trepidation having it outside. But anyway, that's
and let me tell you something, Mary. In the opportunity to make more money, the NFL will run the risk that it doesn't rain at next year's draft.
Got it. Well, for those, Mike, who aren't football fans and many residents, frankly, who live near the art museum area who are put out by all this, why do we care so much about the NFL draft?
Well, that's a really good question. I think pro football in particular, certainly throughout the country, and I think college football for much of the country have become too kind of collective reference points for us as a culture and a society. There aren't too many things that kind of unite hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, doing a particular thing at a particular time. It used to be church for a lot of people. It used to be the nightly news. We don't have as many institutions like that anymore. And I think football is one of the few that's left. I also think, with respect to Philadelphia in particular, there's a visceral connection to the sport, you know, and to the Eagles. Among the four pro teams, you know, five pro teams if you count the Philadelphia Union, the soccer team, the Eagles are clearly first among equals. They are the most popular team by a long shot. So I think a lot of those things, you know, make Philadelphia kind of the perfect environment and made last night kind of the perfect storm for what the NFL wants the draft to be. The draft is selling hope. It is, hey, here were these great players in college, and they might come to your team and make your pro team great.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to the particulars, Mike, about what's going on with the Eagles. Former governor and erstwhile sports analyst Ed Rendell had his eye on first-round pick Christian McCaffrey. He's a running back. He's with the Panthers now, right?
Yes, that's right.
McCaffrey. Well, so what is the need at running back with the Eagles?
It's deep. They need a running back or two. Right now they have Darren Sproles, who is 33 years old, which is old for an NFL running back. And he's, you know, he's dynamic, but he's small, and he can only be used in so many plays in a particular game. Otherwise, he'll wear down. They have a couple other young running backs on their roster, including a player named Wendell Smallwood, who they drafted last year, grew up in Delaware, went to the University of West Virginia. But they're kind of lacking at that position. Generally speaking, the feeling is among NFL player personnel people is that you can find competent running backs later in the draft. So I'm sure that, you know, at some point in this draft, they will address that need. But it is a need, and it's a significant one.
Well, there was some talk about Joe Mixon. He's a talented running back, but he carries some really serious baggage, and he was not picked up in the first round last night. You know, long story short, an assault on a woman. It's on videotape. What are the odds that he will be picked up by somebody and perhaps by the Eagles?
Well, I think he'll be drafted by some NFL team because there's kind of a sliding scale. The later you get into the draft and the less money you have to commit to a particular player, you know, it becomes kind of a risk-reward situation where you say to yourselves, okay, well, the less money we have to commit to the guy, if he works out for us, great, and he keeps his nose clean, that's wonderful. But if he turns out to be a jerk and gets in trouble with the law again, or in Mixon's case, you know, breaks the jaw of a woman and gets caught on videotape doing it, then we can just cut him with fewer repercussions for us. Of course, you know, you're going to have to deal with, you know, the terrible, you know, public relations image of signing a player who's done such a thing. And Mixon is not the only player available in this draft who has a kind of a checkered past. Yeah. There's a running back from Florida State named Dalvin Cook, who's probably going to fall in the draft as well for similar reasons.
All right, to quarterback. Howie Roseman has said the Eagles aren't looking for quarterbacks. Well, he said not in the first round, which, of course, didn't happen last night. Who looks good perhaps today or tomorrow as the draft continues?
Are you talking about quarterbacks specifically?
Yeah. If we even end up with one.
It's hard to say. There was really a run on them in the first round. Three teams made big trades, to move up and get quarterbacks, which it was interesting because part of the reason the Eagles were so aggressive about going to get Carson Wentz last year was that they perceived that this would be a down year for quarterbacks. And so they might as well take their chances and get a guy who they really believed in before lesser players were available. As it turned out, three teams moved up to try to get quarterbacks this year. Whether those players are going to pan out, I don't know. At this point, which quarterbacks are going to move, it's really hard to say. I mean, I think it's such a premium position that there could be somebody going in the second round. But I think the teams that really needed them, like the Houston Texans, like the Kansas City Chiefs, for instance, they made their moves. So I think at this point, teams are going to end up filling some other needs, in rounds two and three.
And the real need for the Eagles is to shore up the offense for Wentz. So what do you think their next move is going to be tonight? I think they've got 43.
They're going to draft at least one cornerback today, if not two. They have to help. They have to get help in the secondary in their defensive backfield. That's really the greatest position of weakness on the team right now. They don't really have a regular player there. They have two excellent safeties in Malcolm Jenkins and Ronnie McLeod. But on the outside, the core cover positions, they don't really have a solid, solidified player at either position. So I think that's where they're headed next.
All right. And just to kind of close up here, let's just go to the Cleveland Browns. They got the first pick last night, and it was, as expected, Myles Garrett, whom sports writer Paul Izadamowicz calls a freakishly athletic. Of course, one man can't bring a team back from the brink, but what can Garrett do for the Browns?
Well, Garrett, is an interesting pick because there are a lot of people who wonder whether he's consistent enough to justify being the number one overall pick. But what the Browns are doing, which is interesting, is they're taking more of kind of a money ball approach to the NFL and really being the first team to do it, which is to say they are hoarding draft picks so that they have as many kind of arrows in their quiver, so to speak, so that when it comes time to fire them at the bullseye, they have more opportunities to hit it. They have a ton of draft picks. They have a bunch of draft picks even in the first round, even next year, I think two or three. And there are some really highly touted quarterback prospects coming out next year. Quarterbacks who are more highly regarded even than the ones that went this year. So the Browns are taking kind of a long view here. The question is whether they're going to make as good a use as possible of all these draft picks. So if Garrett doesn't work out, they've done probably as much as they can to kind of mitigate that.
Yeah.
But by the same token, they still have to get some good players with these picks.
All right. Mike Sielski, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. The story continues through the weekend. Thanks so much for joining us here for Radio Times.
Anytime, Mary. Thank you.
All right. Radio Times continues in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moskowain. So we just talked about the NFL draft. Football fans across the country and even the world are watching. Some, no doubt, feverishly to see what and how their teams will do. So for the rest of the hour, we're going to try to answer this question. What makes a fan? Why are some of us passionate about a football team or a singer, or a soda like Coca-Cola's Surge, so passionate that we're willing to mount a campaign to bring a product back when it's discontinued, or lose sleep as our team loses games? And I'm guilty of that one. Zoe Fraud-Blanar and Aaron Glazer are here with us for the rest of the hour. They've written Super Fandom, How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are. Zoe Fraud-Blanar, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
And Aaron Glazer, so nice to have you with us.
Of course. Thanks for having us on.
And let's get the comment line number out. Good for calling or texting. 267-405-2006. That's, again, 267-405-2006. So I'd like to start with a story you tell at the very beginning of the book. You are co-founders of a company called Squishable. Briefly describe the Squishable product.
Squishables are large stuffed animals. They're quirky, they're artsy, and they're very heavily fan designed. So probably about 50% of what we make these days are created by our fans, of which there are probably over a million now. And they're very creative, and they're very dedicated, and they're also very vocal about telling us what they do and don't want us to make. So we found that listening to them is excellent business sense.
Well, we'll get to that in just a minute, Zoe. But first, I wanted to go back to 2012 when Squishable was planning an online Halloween party. This is just ahead of Hurricane Sandy. And hundreds of your fans from around the globe responded to say they would be there virtually. So as New York City, which is where you're located, is in a declared state of emergency, the Squishable staff is working on the party from various sites across the city. A major hurricane is bearing down. The subways are closed, and you felt you couldn't cancel.
You know, in hindsight, it sounds a bit silly, but at the moment, all we could think was we have hundreds of fans counting on us. The invites have gone out. You know what? Let's do this.
Did that work for you, Aaron?
It did. It was certainly an experience unlike any I've ever had before, sitting upstairs in an apartment where the winds were blazing outside and trying to keep our fans happy by posting pictures and drawing pictures and taking photos of Squishables in Halloween costumes. It was definitely a unique experience that I've never had before or probably will again.
So we knew at some point the power would go out. So we had to get it all in before it did, and then it did.
And the party was a success.
It was. It was very hairy. There was wind. There was rain. We lost power. We lost cell. We lost internet. But the fans kept the party going. We logged in next morning to find out that there had been a countrywide game of truth and dare that some of the super fans had sponsored. They kept it going till long after midnight, even knowing that we were down for the count.
Hmm. So safe to say you have a passionate relationship with your fans. It works both ways. Let's get into that a bit. When Squishable designed a Squishable Shiba Inu, which is a dog breed, your Kickstarter campaign introduced a red dog with circular eye patches. And initially, the response to the concept art was positive, as you tell in your book. But then when you posted the prototype pictures, there was an unexpected fan comment and things changed from there. Aaron, what happened?
So we actually had designed this Kickstarter for the Shiba Inu based off of a contest we had had on our site to see which next dog we should make into a Squishable. And the Corgi had actually won. There's an entire fan base called the Corgi Nation that has taken over edges of the internet in support of the Corgis. But the Shiba Inu came in second, and being a small company, we didn't really have the funding to do both. So we set it up as a Kickstarter, and we had this very large fan following, both from Squishable fans, but from Shiba Inu owners in general. We posted up the picture, and people had done the Kickstarter support to tell us they wanted to make it. And then once we had actually posted the prototype, the response turned very unexpectedly negative. People started telling us that it didn't look like a Shiba Inu, it looked like a fox. And we got very upset because, as you say, we have a very passionate relationship with our fans. And to find out that something they had been so happy about had turned negative actually sent us into a bit of a depression. And we had to figure out how to respond to our fans in a way to keep them happy. And we actually ended up rushing through a second version of that dog in response to what our fans wanted, because we didn't want them to feel upset and unhappy about something they had been so passionate about before and actually supported with their wallets.
Yeah. Well, Zoe, as you both write, it can be, I don't know if terrifying is too strong a word, but to be on the receiving end of fan upset, fan anger, all the more so because fandom uses sometimes the language of extremes. This is the best brand that ever existed, ever. How do you work with that emotion?
Well, fandom, which is to say it's creating these communities around these pieces of pop culture, it really speaks to something very, very deep and personal in people's lives. I think your earlier commentary actually touched on this, that there are these questions about who are we and where do we belong and what can we do to succeed, which are ancient, ancient questions. As long as there's been, you know, culture and religion, there's been these questions. And traditionally, we've answered them through Organized religion and through family groups and organizations based on geographic area. But over the last 200 years, that has shifted as people become more mobile, as people become more educated. And we now understand that no one area has all the questions. So we turn to these pieces of pop culture to really almost define who we are. And when someone messes that relationship up, that can get very, very personal and very intense very quickly, because it's not just a stuffed animal you've messed up. It's part of themselves. It's part of what they use to decide who they are.
So is this, Aaron, a negative side of fandom that perhaps needs to be looked at closely?
I mean, it's interesting in the same way you would describe as kind of a difficult relationship with, say, your local Kiwanis group or even with the religion you belong to. It's not necessarily negative as much as it is just reflective of our identity. And that is things in the fan group you believe in and belong to take a turn that you don't expect. It conflicts with your identity of self and how you believe that you identify with the group and how it represents you, and it creates an internal conflict. Mm-hmm. So it is certainly negative in the sense that from a fan object perspective, having your fans get upset with you is not anything anybody ever wants. But for a fan, it's actually a way to feel out where their own identity lies, what they believe in, and whether the fan object still kind of represents themselves and how they want to represent that view to the outside world.
So super fandom, as you kind of alluded to earlier, Zoe, isn't new. In your book, you tell the story of Alice Drake, a woman who came of age in the late 19th century. And I'll just say, I'll throw this out there before you tell the story. She found the home of the late composer Franz Liszt in Germany. Take it from there.
Yes, indeed. Alice Drake was actually a representative of a number of these musicomaniacs is what they were called. It was an actual medical term, which it's not clear if anyone was ever treated for it, but certainly was considered a serious medical condition where people would have an unseemly and uncomfortable over-enthusiasm for music. So Alice Drake in particular, she traveled to Weimar, Germany, and she broke into his house, Franz Liszt's house, among a number of composers whose houses she, in fact, broke into. Mozart, she never actually made it into Wagner's, but she tried. She was stopped by the servants, even though she bribed them. So definitely a very passionate young lady, but actually only one of this vast population of people who suddenly in the Victorian era were finding this outlet for their repressed longings and their need for fun and enthusiasm, which Victorian culture didn't really supply.
Well, how has modern technology then further shaped fandom, Aaron?
So the rise of the internet has kind of reduced our barrier to entry to fandom, where it would have been hard even 20 or 30 years ago to find a group of people who shared your passion for something as esoteric as maybe a 16-year-old metal band. With the internet, it's very easy to find people who share the things you like, and so trying to find out another half dozen or dozen people who share your passion is much easier where you can just go on the web, find a forum, and share that information with them. So with the rise of the internet, we can find people to share this information and be social with, and the fandom has to be very social. And it also reduces the time that we need to spend finding our fan object. You no longer have to walk to the bookstore and browse through 50 books to find the next science fiction book you're going to buy. You can click a button on your Kindle and it's right in front of you and you can read it. So you have a lot more spare time to spend on kind of the ancillary activities around fandom. So you can turn around and write your own fan fiction with an extra couple of hours that you would have spent going to Barnes & Noble.
Can it also kind of increase perhaps the heat of fandom, you know, when there's somebody who is in the public eye, people are fans, you know, perhaps that perception can turn on a dime to the benefit or to the negative of that fan object, Zoe?
It is. The internet makes it easier, but it also means there's more of it. Things which never would have gotten to that minimum viable group previously, they now immediately get there, and once they get there, they have that type of interaction much more intensely, and there's much more of it. So, for example, in the past, things like, we call them in the book the fan-like activities, things like pilgrimages and creating content such as drawings and things like that, making rituals and traditions, creating collections, socializing with each other. All of these are things which the internet has made so much easier, And it's so much easier to also have that close connection now. You don't have to search for years to make that perfect collection. You can simply create a search term for it.
Well, the internet can also contribute to the success of a fan's business, if you will. Tell us what a buyout is and related to somebody, I guess, like Justin Bieber.
A buyout is a particular ritual which was created by Justin Bieber fans a little while ago, and this is a fantastic ritual that they did. Very few Justin Bieber fans these days, if we're looking at his preteen and early teen fan group, will in fact have a CD player. That's something which has kind of become a bit archaic in our modern world, at least for that age group. And yet, these groups of people will go to stores and they will buy out every copy of the CD in order to help force his numbers up in the charts. And this is not only a very effective ritual, it helps him particularly, but also one that they can never use. They have to donate them to charity afterwards. They can't play those CDs.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, so they
for
can
the
be
most part.
They can be bottom line a huge source of money flow for the object of their devotion, fans.
Absolutely, but it is also very important to remember that consumers and fans are two very different groups with very different needs. We have consumers who buy the thing which they like, and they may be very loyal to that thing, but fandom is a different type of beast. A fan is someone who does activities on behalf of that fan object. We say in the book, fandom is a verb. It's a set of undertakings that may or may not actually have any sort of commercial aspect at all.
I like a party. Yeah.
Yes, very much so.
So let's talk about the fact, and again, this is the power that fans have. They can even save a product, I should say, that looks as if it's headed toward extinction. Tell us about the Impossible Project, Aaron.
So Polaroid, as everyone knows, the Polaroid cameras that were so popular from the 60s and 70s and all through the 80s and 90s, with the rise of digital film, basically started losing large vats of its market share. And as they got to the late 2000s, Polaroid decided they actually were going to stop producing the consumer grade film that had gone on all the Polaroid cameras. And they'd actually stopped producing the cameras a couple of years before. And there was this huge outrage from all of the long-term Polaroid fans, people who had personally identified with Polaroid as the art medium, or they remembered from growing up with their grandparents taking pictures with the Polaroids and their teenage years going to parties with Polaroid photos, that this was going to become a lost art form. And as Polaroid was getting ready to close its last factory, a set of entrepreneurs actually stepped in and bought the factory literally days before it was going to close and started a project called the Impossible Project, which was designed to recreate the film that Polaroid used to make. And they actually had to start from the bottom up because the entire supply chain that fed into Polaroid film actually contained hundreds and hundreds of chemicals. It was a very complex process. And most of the factories that sold the chemicals to Polaroid either had shut down or their minimum orders were so high that a small company like Impossible could never make it work. So Impossible bought this factory, took a couple of years, and actually produced a consumer-grade Polaroid film that was, in their own description, very, very bad. The quality was very poor. It took an hour to develop. And they actually turned around and sold this film to this group of loyal Polaroid fans who they called pioneers, who were willing to buy a very poor quality product because they were so passionate about Polaroid film coming back that they knew if they could support Impossible over the next couple of years, Impossible could build a better product. And it's a very unique experience because very few manufacturers have the luxury of selling a product that's pretty poor quality and having people actually buy it. But because they had a fan base, and this fan base that existed around Polaroid, it gave them honestly, a cash flow and a number of years to build back the product that people really wanted. And Impossible has grown over years and years, and their actual consumer-grade film is significantly better now. The quality is pretty good. It looks very similar to an original Polaroid picture, and they were able to do that based on the support of all of their fans.
And they still use the Polaroid name.
So they do not use the Polaroid name, and they never have.
Okay.
Because Polaroid has turned itself into a licensing company, which is the other thing that comes out of fandom. Polaroid doesn't make products anymore. Polaroid hasn't made products in years. All Polaroid does is license the Polaroid name to other manufacturers. So you can't, and you can buy a Polaroid camera, but it's not actually made by Polaroid anymore. Okay. So Impossible makes instant film for use in Polaroid cameras, but has stepped away from the Polaroid name.
So quite an extraordinary undertaking. Zoe, is there something in perhaps a person's personality that might make them more likely to be a fan, willing to go to great lengths to preserve a product as opposed to just being a consumer?
We're all fans of something, right? And we're probably fans of many, many things as we build this identity around ourselves and tell the world and ourselves who we are. But having said that, there are certain times in our lives when we're probably more receptive to becoming a fan. Periods of change, maybe periods of crisis, periods where we're searching for new cultural symbols to tell ourselves who we are. So there's a reason why we get so many of our fandoms, maybe from our teenage years, when we're going through this very exciting but fairly brutal set of changes in our lives.
Sure.
A lot of us trace our most beloved fandoms back to that period. And we may collect fandoms whenever we move, for example. When we go to college, we may suddenly become fans of the sports team of that school. When we move to a new city, we probably become fans of the food that's there. So often you could actually even make a fandom biography, if you wanted to, seeing what you were into at different times of your lives based on what you needed during that time in your life.
Yeah. Well, quickly, before we get to the break, where does identity shorthand play into fandom? What is that?
So as we've changed and stepped away from things like religion and geographic identity, we need ways to tell other people who we are. So whereas we might have worn a cross to indicate that we were Christian beforehand, now we wear signs of fandom. So you'll wear a Marvel T-shirt to express the fact that you identify with Captain America or Iron Man. And it tells something about who you are. So if you wear a Star Wars T-shirt with Han shot first, other Star Wars fans know what you mean, and it kind of tells a little bit about who you are to the world without having to lay out your own biography and tell everyone for a long time about who you actually are.
And perhaps for Eagles fans now, a Barnett jersey. So, all right, we're going to talk more about fandom in just a moment here on Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're joined by Zoe Fraud-Blanar, and Aaron Glazer. And stay with us. There's more just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We're taking a close look at fandom this hour, what it means to be a fan, and why we spend so much time perhaps obsessing about teams, players, musicians, foods, etc. Our guests for the remainder of the hour, Zoe Fraud-Blanar and Aaron Glazer. They are co-authors of Super Fandom, How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are. And if you'd like to join the conversation, here's our comment line number, 267-405-2006. Again, 267-405-2006. A call or text, both work. So fandom can also work for the greater good. Aaron, you entitled part of a chapter, Harry Potter and the Fair Trade Chocolate. What's that story?
So there's a very large group of Harry Potter fans who have kind of organized themselves around a belief that the way Harry Potter approaches the world is how they want to approach the world. And they've actually set up a number of different activities for Harry Potter fans to allow themselves to kind of learn and develop. They even have something called the Hermione Granger Leadership Academy, which is trains people to be better leaders in the world. But Harry Potter fans discovered a couple of years ago that the company that owns the Harry Potter parks, Universal Studios, makes chocolate frogs. And if you remember the movies, there's a scene on the trains where these frogs jump along the side of the trains and turn into chocolate and they eat them. And chocolate production is a very difficult type of industry where a lot of the chocolate's produced is actually picked by underage workers and some of them are even slaves. And the Harry Potter Alliance decided that this wasn't something they believed in. And this is something that Harry Potter himself would not have allowed. So they waged a campaign against Universal to get Universal to make all of their chocolate production fair trade. And to begin with, Universal decided that this was a silly group of people they didn't want to deal with and kind of brushed them aside. So they spent years actually working against Universal, even getting J.K. Rowling herself involved in saying, this is something that we should believe in. This is something that Harry Potter wouldn't do. Why would we let you use chocolate of questionable origins.
Well, let me jump in for a moment. Isn't it amazing that they spent years on this one campaign regarding these?
It is. It absolutely is.
Where does that come from?
Well, if you think about it, it's very similar to kind of all of our organizations. You have people who are passionate about anything and organize to make changes they believe in. We don't think different of it when it's the Shriners who organize a hospital or Kiwanis organizing a local bake sale to try and support the educational system. We think it's weird because Harry Potter fans are a group of people that are organized around a different sensibility. Mm-hmm. But it's still just an organization that finds things they believe in that kind of match with their own internal identities.
Yeah. And the end of the story is, I interrupted you there, so you have to tell it.
Absolutely. Universal caved, not very happily. They wrote a very succinct and short letter telling them that all future chocolate production would be fair trade certified, meaning that they could trace the production to its origins and they would not be using these questionable practices. Hmm. They were clearly not especially happy about it. It wasn't something they were enthusiastic about, but the Harry Potter Alliance won.
Oh, isn't that something? Let's talk, Zoe, about fan revolt. And you also write of bad management, and you tell the story of Bill Samuels Jr. and his son, Rob, who run the family Maker's Mark whiskey business. And this is interesting to learn. It takes about 6 years to age a barrel of this top-of-the-line bourbon. And when demand from Asian markets exploded, Bill and Rob decided to water the whiskey down just a bit so they could stretch their supply to satisfy Asian customers before other brands beat them to this market. But then they make a mistake, and take it from there, Zoe.
Well, this was a completely legitimate business decision for them to make. First of all, they had studied it. They were sure this was not going to change the flavor at all because a higher alcohol content actually dulls the taste buds. And in fact, the proof, the alcohol content of their product was not actually a selling point in general for most people. So they decided they were going to be transparent about it. They'd heard that their fans were very enthusiastic. They wanted to make sure they had buy-in. They sent out an email to their fans on a Friday afternoon. The internet waited a couple of hours, and then the internet lost it. They had a backlash on the scale that no one possibly could have predicted. There was hate mail. There were revolts on their Facebook and Twitter feeds. There were, in fact, people who interrupted real-life events that they had been holding to complain about this. People gave them threats and harassment and it became this huge thing. Media got involved and made headlines with terrible puns in them, which is what usually happens when you have fandom. And it turned huge. They lasted about a week. And they, in fact, felt the need to recall the change. They sent out another note a week later saying, "We're sorry, we hear you. Wow, we hadn't expected that." And they, in fact, did roll back the change.
And actually, ironically, ended up with its highest grossing quarter ever.
They did, because enough people had collected the last bottles of the previous proof because they thought those might be the last ever in existence. They did, in fact, have their highest one ever. As a bit of a final note on that, the few bottles of slightly lower proof whiskey that had been produced are now valuable collector's items. So it just goes to show.
Yeah. But, there is a disturbing note running through here. I mean, fans are so upset that they're making threats. They're writing harassing notes. And as you write, Aaron, it's a subject which has won a lot of attention, fandom, from academia. Does this address this aspect of it? And if a fan is kind of at that point, isn't there some at some point, you need to step back and say, okay, it's only a bourbon.
Of course. I mean, obsession is dangerous no matter what you're obsessed with. And fandom takes it a little bit further because just like so much of it is tied into our sense of identity, fans are willing to give their fan objects a lot of leeway. They are a hardcore fan until the very moment they're not. And when they flip, they tend to go very negative very quickly. So it always is dangerous. You always have the idea if you do that, regardless of what it is, becoming obsessed and then feeling a break and turning very negative is never good for anyone, but it also tends to pass very quickly.
Okay. What
you find is that fans, when they go negative, will get very upset for a very short period of time, and then they tend to just to move on to another fandom. So they may get upset with Maker's Mark. Some of them will come back. The ones that don't might just turn around and start drinking Johnny Walker, pick back up their fandom with that, and the negativity that was associated with the previous fandom tends to go away.
So at the end of the day, what is the best way then for the object of fandom to deal with fan rebellion? Just to realize that it should probably blow over quickly, Zoe?
Well, there is no one rule, but it is very important to remember that fans are conservative. They are literally a group that exists in order to conserve something, to preserve something in the state it was when they first found it. And that means they are going to stifle change. Sometimes that can be good. It means it keeps them true to the roots of what that fan object means. But sometimes there are actual real decisions that need to be made that could alienate fans, and that's okay. So it's very important to remember that when fans rebel, when they turn into that big, scary, angry mob, they can feel like the entire internet is bearing down on the fan object. It's not necessarily true. A small group of angry people on the internet can feel like a much, much bigger group. Yeah. It's actually called the majority illusion is the academic term for that. Okay. So it's important to take it with a grain of salt. They need to be taken seriously, but they certainly shouldn't be taken literally.
I'd like to get to a fascinating fan object that you write about in your book, created largely by a fan base, and this is Hatsune Miku. Who is she, and where did she come from, Aaron?
So Hatsune Miku is a 16-year-old Japanese singer. She has been 16 since she was created because she is entirely a computer-generated software program. She's what's called a Vocaloid, and Vocaloids are a piece of software kind of like if you were making music on a synthesizer, you can actually feed music into the Vocaloid software, and it will sing it on your behalf. Hatsune Miku was founded by Krypton Future Media as kind of the front woman for this software package they were selling, and she turned into a huge sensation in Japan. All of Hatsune Miku's songs are created by fans. These are fans who write the songs she's going to sing. And she actually has several thousand hits on iTunes and YouTube and the Japanese version of those sites, mm-hmm. all written by fans. So Krypton Future Media doesn't write music, and Hatsune Miku herself can't write music. But she has this gigantic following. She tours to thousands and thousands of people. She actually tours as a hologram where they project her up on stage. She's done television commercials for Domino's Pizza yeah. and for Toyota and Google in Japan. And she doesn't exist. She exists entirely as the creation of her fans.
I actually saw some of her performance online, and it's astounding. We've got thousands of people at a venue, and they're singing her songs along with her. It's kind of their songs along with her. So it's a story of the modern age. But fans have a lot of control here. They have complete control. So is it the founding company? Was it? Did you say Krypton?
Krypton Future Media.
Krypton Future Media. There's no control there.
So there is an attempt at control, but almost none. Krypton Future Media made the decision to release Hatsune Miku under a Creative Commons license, which is pretty much almost like Disney saying, hey, here's Mickey Mouse. Go do whatever you want within reason. So Krypton Future Media has a couple of caveats. You're not supposed to use her for anything that would be X-rated or anything especially violent. But once you've put a character like this out into the public, it's very difficult to control. So Krypton doesn't have future control. It's not like they can just reach out and grab someone who has taken Hatsune Miku and done something they don't like with it and revoke their privileges. Mm. So they've attempted to kind of keep it very open and allow fans to do whatever they want with a little bit of caveats on it. But as things do on the internet, they frequently go a little bit darker than I think even Krypton would like to admit is out there.
Yeah, I guess that's inevitable. So the character is 16. How long are people fans of Hatsune Miku? Is it pretty much a year or so, and then they move on to something else, Zoe?
It's interesting.
Or Aaron?
Well, it's interesting.
Sorry?
Either. A lot of people who are fans of Miku actually say the unchangeability about her, the fact that she's never going to grow old, she's never going to change, she's never going to get drunk and embarrass herself in the magazines, that's actually one of her best parts. The very inhumanity of her makes her safe. She's never going to metaphorically water down her bourbon on them.
Why are some people seemingly immune to fandom? Aaron?
It's interesting. I think you would find that very few people are immune to fandom. I think as we've changed, our view of what fandom actually is has evolved. Very few people aren't fans of something, but when we've talked about fandom, especially historically, we've talked about things that are a little bit more stigmatized. So things like science fiction and fantasy fandom that people have looked down on. But we just spent a lot of time in your previous segment talking about the Eagles. And I would say you're going to have a lot of trouble in Philadelphia finding someone who isn't somewhat of a fan of the Eagles. Yeah. They may not be standing outside with 100,000 other people watching the draft, but because of the environment they're in, they have some connection with it. And they may be a lower tier fan, but they are still a fan. So I think you're going to find that while people say they are immune to fandom, most people actually are fans of something. They just don't think of it as fandom. They might be a fan of the opera, but because the opera is upper class, they wouldn't describe themselves as a fan. They might describe themselves as an aficionado. Mm-hmm. But fandom is fairly universal.
So, and there's a subgroup of fans called smart fans. What is a smart fan? What's the definition there?
We say that smart fans are actually all fans. The term comes, in fact, from pro wrestling. It's a reference to the fact that pro wrestling fans understand that this thing that they love, that they care about so deeply, is not necessarily by the traditional definition of the term real in the way that we think is real. But
as
that's
we just
actually
saw with
true.
Hatsune Miku. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. But that's actually true of almost all fan objects. There's almost always some level of playing make-believe with everything that we love. You know, Darth Vader isn't really trying to take over the universe. Johnny Cash wasn't really a cowboy. We like to play pretend with these things, and that doesn't in any way invalidate the very real feelings, the very important cultural work that it does for us. It simply means that we're smart. We understand that we have kind of this dual love. We love the thing itself, but we also love the thing it stands for, and we're willing to overlook the inherent commercial implications in the thing itself in order to get those feelings that we want.
Yeah. Well, and apparently smart fans of professional wrestling are so very much appreciated that gags like the Spanish announcer's table are concocted just for them.
Yes.
Which is what? You have to explain that.
This is a special trick table, which at least once a match, someone gets thrown to, and its sole purpose is to explode into incredible splinters for the purpose of making a big noise and looking very impressive. And it is kind of an open secret that there is this safe table for people to go through. In fact, wrestlers may even have been surprised if they make it to the end of the match and the Spanish announcer's table is still standing.
So what are you fans of? Aaron, is there anything you'd care to pass along to disclose?
So as we were talked about earlier with fandom being something that happens as different changes in your life occur, I had a child a couple of years ago, and I found myself spending a lot of nights up taking care of him and discovered that I became a fan of the television show Archer, because I think Archer is something very entertaining to watch, but they've also done a very good job of building the context around the fandom. In the last season, they did a scavenger hunt where embedded in the television show were a lot of clues that you could actually follow to help you figure out more behind-the-scenes information. There was even an entire Reddit board that I became obsessed with that helped track down these clues and figure out this kind of behind-the-scenes context of the show.
Well, that's kind of fun. So you don't take it to more than that extent, though. It's just kind of a fun thing to do as you're watching your child, correct?
I probably spent more time on the internet and fan forums than I would like to admit in a public space. I haven't yet gone out and done anything in public, but I certainly have posted and interacted with other fans for a large amount of time.
All right. And Zoe, quickly from you?
I'd say Golden Age murder mysteries. Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers. I know what it means when they find the body in the library. I know what it means when someone mentions that they were an actress in a past life, and I'm willing to tell everyone about it at great length loudly.
And full disclosure, I'm a Phillies fan, and these days I'm happy. All right. Well, Aaron Glazer and Zoe Frublinari, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
They are co-authors of Super Fandom, How Our Obsessions Are Changing What We Buy and Who We Are. And don't forget to visit our Facebook page and listen to our podcast. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.